PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, Happy New Year and welcome back to our episodes of the PD Podscast with me, your host, Pranay Budev, a consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon from England. We will continue to have an episode released on the first Sunday of each month of 2021, and we will continue to explore the journeys and careers of many legends and leaders within the field of pediatric orthopedics and explore other realms, including the current COVID pandemic, the role of physician wellness, and where future research and potentially artificial intelligence and technology is going to take us. Our first episode is with our homegrown Mr. Nick Nicolau, who is a consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon from Sheffield Children's Hospital, speaking about all things pediatric and adolescent knee. Continue to follow us on all major podcast platforms. We can also be found on Twitter at PDPods, and our website is www.pdpods.com. Please don't hesitate to get in touch with us with your recommendations and feedback. Let's get into it. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very lucky to be joined by Mr. Nick Nicolau. I've actually known Nick for nearly 10 years now when I was very early on in my training days, and it's so great to see him having developed quite this pivotal role in the field, especially with regards to knee surgery, something that has typically been overlooked and more common with our North American cousins. He also is the chair and BISCOS lead of the Joint Steering Committee on Pediatric Soft Tissue Pathology and sits on the Research Committee of BISCOS. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation talking all things pediatric adolescent knee. Nick, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
So Nick, I've known you for a long, long time, but I ask all my guests, you know, tell us your early beginnings. You know, tell us about why you went into medicine, how you got into orthopedics, and a bit about your training.
Yes. So why did I become a doctor? I think because where I went to school in North London, if you were reasonably smart, you either became a lawyer or a doctor. And I think it's more by really advertising other people, advertising the career to me than anything else. Although now looking back on it, it's a good choice. So I went to university in London, King's, before it merged with Guy's and Tommy's. And I did my orthopaedic training on the Southeast Thames region. So that's how it all started. And pretty much paediatric orthopaedics was an area of interest from the beginning, simply because it seemed more challenging than the other subspecialties. And I'm sure we've all found this. The range of pathology, the complexity of the work was always really interesting to me. And I developed that passion really while I was a trainee at Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells. And then that was enhanced later with my fellowships because I spent a year at Sheffield, a year at Stamoront Great Ormond Street, and did some travelling work around the world as well, spending 3 months in Bern with Teddy Slongo, which was a great experience, before starting as a consultant.
So tell me a bit about your fellowships. Which fellowships did you do in Sheffield? There's a numerous number of fellowships available for people when they want to go to Sheffield. Who did you work with particularly there? And also in your Goshar and OH one, that's, I'm sure, linked with Professor Eastwood, who's been a previous guest of ours. Tell us your experience and what you learned from each one of your mentors over that time.
Yeah, so I suppose we're all a product of the people that train us, aren't we? And they're the ones that give us initiative, show us their skills. And at Sheffield, I was the National Paediatric Orthopaedic Fellow, which is the one where you have a little bit of a rein on administration, such as rota organising and stuff. But I worked with all of the consultants who were there at the time, who are now obviously my colleagues, in particular with regards to knees. Geraint Davis was my colleague, who's since retired, who I saw a lot of the soft tissue knee stuff with. Great Ormond Street and Stanmore, in particular Deborah Eastwood, Andreas Raposch, were very key in teaching me a lot of stuff. Clinicians that I have a lot of respect for is where I picked up my interest in osteogenesis imperfecta, which is still part of my clinical practice, although most things knee now tend to take over, really, if I'm honest with you. So pretty much the whole of the Sheffield department and were in very instrumental in my training, as were the whole of the team, particularly at Great Ormond Street. And I'm grateful for the education and the time they gave me to teach me my trade, so to speak.
Now, you were first appointed in Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells, working down there. And I'm sure, as most young consultants, you started with quite a broad practice. Mm-hmm. Tell me what that was. And obviously, you ended up in Sheffield. How did that come about? And how did you sort of niche yourself into a specialty?
Yeah, so I spent 4 years at Tunbridge Wells. It's a great unit. My colleague Marcus Catchbrunner, were just the two of us at the time. Fantastic guy to work with. We did a lot of work together. My practice was very general, from surgical dislocation for Skiffy to limb deformity correction, as well as all the other stuff. It's actually harder to be a consultant in a DGH than it is in a teaching hospital. Because there's less of you there. You don't have the opportunity of nipping out and asking a colleague for their advice and their help. You have to wait for more regional meetings to do that. So real struggle, but you can only really provide the care according to the services that are around you. And obviously the advantage of Sheffield was I had an interest in osteogenesis imperfecta, limb deformity type stuff, and an interest in knees as well. And I almost fell into the knees because part of my SPR training, I had the pleasure of working with a lot of very good adult soft tissue knee surgeons in the Southeast region, as well as seeing the stuff being done by my colleagues at Sheffield, and worked together collaboratively at Tunbridge Wells with my colleague Paul Gibb, who has been very instrumental in teaching me a lot of knee stuff. So from there, when I went to Sheffield, you're in a department of very, very good clinicians with great clinical skills. What are you going to do that someone's not already doing better than you could manage, if I'm honest with you? And knees was the only thing really, with the imminent retirement of Geraint Davis, that needed to be taken on. And the service has just ballooned from there, really, trying to provide a high standard of care with a multidisciplinary input. Because the knee team is not just made up of me. I have two other colleagues that come and help me from the adult sector, and that's how the whole service has developed.
And we're definitely going to get into that, how you set up that service and the role of an MDT and who is pivotal in helping you sort of deliver that. But before we get there, I don't want to skip out on the traveling fellowships you did, which it seems you did as a consultant. You did both the BISCOS and the EPOS fellowship. Where did those take you? Who were you with? And why do you think those fellowships are so important in sort of career development as a young surgeon?
Yeah, so the key thing here is that once you become a consultant, you're learning changes. You're not swapping rounds every year or every 6 months from unit to unit. So you don't quite get the ability to learn at the same rate as you would do unless it's on an individual basis, other than conferences and things like this. The advantage of these fellowships is you get to go as a guy or a lady who's already doing their stuff. So you already know how to manage pathology, but then you go and see someone else doing it. And that's a great way to learn. When you already know how to do something, it's you learn much more quickly. So for the first of the fellowships, which was the BISCOS funded one, I'd encourage any consultant that's thinking about it to apply, because it's a great opportunity for you to pick to spend 2 weeks in any centre that you want in the world, or 1 week in one and 1 week in another. So I spent a week in with Perry Schoenecker in St. Louis, and Eric Gordon was there as well, was quite pivotal. These guys were excellent. They really looked after me. They showed me an awful lot of stuff. I saw surgery. I saw patients coming back to clinic. And when you travel, you learn a lot more in a short space of time than you would do than if you were working somewhere for 6 months, because you can use whatever time you have to make sure you're picking up new skills or seeing new things. Perry Schoenecker in particular and Eric Gordon at St. Louis were fantastic. And I really enjoyed my time there. I learned a lot about general stuff, including limb deformity, Perthes disease, looking at how they manage that and seeing the outcomes was excellent. Seeing how they manage their adolescent hip pathology, particularly the Skiffies and the periacetabular work that gets done there, is again as an MDT. After that, I spent a week in Texas Scottish Rite, and just got a general idea of what the guys do down in Dallas as well. The other fellowship was the EPOS funded fellowship. I would recommend any relatively new consultant to think about joining EPOS. It's a great way to network and meet other people, discuss research, set up projects, arrange to visit other units. And that was a traveling thing that rotated around North American centers. And it went to we went to Washington, we went to Boston, we ended up in Atlanta as well, and we spent some time in Cincinnati. And all these different things, you get to meet people and develop networks. For example, in Cincinnati, Chatel Parikh is a pediatric knee surgeon. It was the first time I had the chance to see someone that specialized specifically in pediatric sports. Look how he set up his service, how he managed his patients, what procedures he was doing, what he'd learned from the time he was doing them. Very, very useful time. And then, of course, it ends with the Posner meeting in which at that stage was in Atlanta, which was another good opportunity to see the North American meetings. Posner is not one that many of us from the UK actually visit.
Yeah, and, you know, echoing exactly what you've said, I was lucky enough to go on a traveling fellowship for hip preservation, and took me to meet Perry Schenica in St. Louis, and I got to go to Boston and a few other places. And, you know, I highly recommend these traveling fellowships. And there are lots of opportunities available out there. And as you said, it's more about building relationships and then keeping in contact, either for collaboration or even for just asking questions, as I still do with you sometimes, having known you for a while now. So let's get into pediatric and adolescent knee. I think you've sort of set it up quite nicely, you know, on your EPOS fellowship, you know, you sort of got to go and see how a unit had been set up, the sort of protocols that have been set up, and then, you know, timely for you in Sheffield that there was a sort of need for this. But in the UK, there really hasn't been a strong subspecialty in pediatric knee that I knew of. It might be just my ignorance, but, you know, I've attended BISCOS for many years now, and there was never much about pediatric knee in the meetings. And there certainly wasn't many people that I knew that were treating them regularly. It was largely done by sort of adult soft tissue surgeons. But now working in the practice, you know, we're getting patients younger and younger. We have those who maybe have congenital absence of the ACL. And then we've also noticed a significant increase in ACL injuries in young individuals. I think it was the Australian registry that said there's about 150% increase over the past 10 years. Why do you think that is? Why are we seeing more knee pathology in pediatrics, or is it just now that we're more aware of it?
Okay, so I suppose if we're talking about, for example, specifically the ACL, the rates have gone up massively in the UK too, as well as worldwide. And it's multifactorial. It's number one, because we are getting better at diagnosing the pathology, imaging better clinical examination. Two, it's the fact that contact sports now is organized at a much younger age, so more young kids are participating in it. Kids are bigger, so they're heavier and higher than maybe taller than they were maybe two decades ago. It's the type of sport specialization, so more contact sport, less play from a younger age, that also predisposes. It's the change in, I suppose, what we could call the sexist distribution of sport, where boys played football and girls didn't. Now sport is much more equally distributed, as it should be, between the different sexes, so you get more female participation in sport. And remember that there's a difference in the injury prevalence according to age that differs between the sexes as well. So all these factors are contributing and have resulted in increases to the point now where we're seeing a lot more than we used to everywhere, not just in the UK, but around Europe and around the whole world.
And tell me, MRI is typically the gold standard for identifying soft tissue knee pathology, but there is a variable service in provided in different hospitals. What are your sort of indications for doing an MRI, and should they be reviewed by a specialist pediatric MSK consultant? Obviously, we always want to correlate our clinical exam to radiological findings, but in this age group, sometimes it can be quite difficult. And there is, you know, if we're to do surgery on them, it's quite a chunk of their, you know, school career or whatever that may be affected.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the key thing about MRI we need to remember is that it's not 100% diagnostic for an ACL injury. In fact, if you look at some of the more historical and more recent studies, and that's regardless if you're using 1.5 or 3 TMR scanners, it's probably going to miss probably about 10% is the figure I would quote. It's not just the scan itself, it's how the scan sequences are taken, because they differ from hospital to hospital. It's the size of the scan cuts, because most people will use 3mm slices, sometimes bigger in certain sequences. So you can imagine in one slice, you can miss a complete injury very, very easily. MRI is very useful for soft tissue knee pathology. It's probably even worse for meniscal tears, and particularly in kids, because of the vascularity of the meniscus. It can fail to identify a tear, or it can identify a tear when it's not really present. And the MRI sensitivity for meniscal pathology in kids is probably only about 70%. And that's before you start looking at more variations in meniscal tears, such as RAB lesions, root lesions, etc. Clinical examination is the most important thing in all parts of medicine, and knee injuries is no different. The history always will give you a guide to what's going on. So mechanism of injury, and in particular the presence of a hemarthrosis, and not necessarily an acute tense hemarthrosis, that implies something's happened acutely that's bled significantly. But any onset of an effusion in the knee should raise the suspicion that something's happened. And in those kids, the history, the mechanism of injury, the clinical appearance of the knee will guide you as to whether you need to do an MRI scan or not.
Now, we're going to go on to sort of how you manage them and what the difference is between sort of managing the young patient versus a typical adult patient. But before we get into that, let's talk about how you've set up your service up in Sheffield. You mentioned you have a couple of colleagues who come and help you. I know one of them is Fazal Ali from Chesterfield. Tell me how that has come about, and why you feel that it's necessary to have that even at this stage of your career.
Okay, so I mean, it's obviously my name that's associated with the Sheffield Knee Service, but it all pivots around Fazal, my colleague from Chesterfield. So Fazal is a very experienced knee surgeon that was doing a lot of kids in his practice. And the fact is, with ACL surgery, it's like all surgery. If you're going to be good at something, you need to be doing it regularly. You need to be properly trained. You need to be able to carry it out successfully. And this is particularly the case where complication rates are high. So for the pediatric ACL, although, you know, compared to a lot of the surgery that children's orthopedic surgeons will do, the procedure isn't particularly complicated. It's the arthroscopic skills to carry it out successfully. So when I came to Sheffield, for me, there was no point in me starting off doing ACL reconstructions, because I'd seen some being done before and been involved with a number of cases. And certainly even at Tunbridge Wells, when I was a consultant there, all the ACLs, I used to do them as dual cases with my colleague Paul Gibb. So it started even from before I got to Sheffield. And that crossover and that cross-pollination between the surgeon doing the surgery most frequently and the surgeon that deals with the age group has what's allowed us to develop a really good multidisciplinary process that now encompasses two adult surgeons. Paul Haslam is another colleague that comes and works at the children's from Doncaster. So there's three of us there. Soon we'll have to be four consultants because of the amount of work that's been generated. And that's a really good core to start developing an excellent high quality team. As well as that, we have a specific pediatric extended scope practitioner who helps particularly when patients come from out of area where the therapy might not be properly supervised. These are all things that make a difference, because it's not just the actual procedure. There are a number of reasons why kids are different to adults.
So let's go into sort of the management side. Obviously, there is a big difference between treating kids and adults. So tell me a bit about how you manage your acute ACL tears with regards to prehabilitation. When do you consider reconstruction? Is there any role for primary repair? And then we'll get into specifics more about, you know, what grafts are recommended and sort of physeal sparing techniques and what really the evidence supports.
Okay, so we'll deal with ACL repair because I think people need to be very cautious about carrying out this technique. There's been quite a good recent article in the American JBJS looking at ACL repair, although not specifically for children, that has said that it should be avoided. It's a bit different in kids, but the evidence isn't really there yet, because in order to treat an ACL tear by repair, you need to pick it up early. So you need to be able to diagnose it and get it to theatre relatively quickly, and balance that with the risk of arthrofibrosis, which is a big problem that we see in kids' knees if they're operated on too early. So be cautious, and then pretty much there will be guidance soon that tells you a little about what to do if you're considering ACL repair in kids. But with regards to someone presenting with an acute ACL injury to my clinic that's clinically diagnosed, it would be to get an MRI scan to look for associated meniscal pathology. We have about 70% associated meniscal pathology with our ACLs if we look at our data cohorts. at the time of arthroscopy, partly because we get patients too late, which is a big problem here in the UK that they don't deal with in other parts of Europe. Prehabilitation is important, the reason being to get the knee nice and strong, because a strong knee before surgery is one that will recover well after surgery. And on the flip side of the coin, a knee that doesn't move fully before surgery will definitely not move fully after surgery. So that's where you need to be careful. Make sure full range of movement is present before you consider the procedure. Meniscal pathology is the thing that will drive you forward to doing the surgery more quickly, particularly if the knee is locked. Whether you do the ACL acutely at the same time is completely up to personal preference, bearing in mind that a meniscal tear with an unstable knee is unlikely to heal. So all these things are interrelated. After surgery, for me, the reason most people fall down with ACL surgery in kids is the rehabilitation. That, for me, is the most important part. It's the part that we tend to get wrong, and it's the part that I've had to work the hardest to get right at Sheffield. I'm now finally at the point where I'm happy, despite the fact we don't really have objective measures for when we should be considering certain things or not in terms of return to participation in contact sport. That's the area where we need to be focused in ACL. It's there, and it's also the prevention of injury in the first place, so we don't have to do the surgery anyway. These are important areas. With regards to the technique of ACL reconstruction, again, we aren't really well guided by the literature, because a lot of systematic reviews that compare techniques will do so with very varying techniques of surgery. Some of the more historical techniques by which people did ACLs are lumped together when they're clearly different procedures. So that is quite a complex area, but the vast majority of kids that you will see will be sort of 14 plus in terms of bone age. For the vast majority of those, a transphysial reconstruction is going to be the go-to technique of choice, with or without modifications, depending on who you are and how you do your procedure.
Now, I remember sitting at the first knee course you organised, which was the BISCOS knee course a few years back now, and that was attended by 85% adult knee surgeons. I was shocked when I saw everyone saying that they would do a transphysial when it came to the case reports, and you were talking about younger and younger children. So tell me, is transphysial okay? Do we need to worry about growth? And what would be your suggestion for cutoffs of when they potentially should be referred to a pediatric center like Sheffield? And is there any sort of assessment that you do post-operatively to ensure there is no issues with growth arrest?
Yeah, so growth disturbance is the main worry. And I remember when I was at Tunbridge Wells, I said to Paul Gibb, who was an excellent adult knee surgeon, I says, Paul, why do you send your ACLs away in the skeletally immature kids? And he said to me, because I don't want to get growth arrest. And I says, well, if you do them, it gets growth arrest, I'll fix it for you. And that's how the knee service in adolescent kids started at Tunbridge Wells before I left there. And this is a worry for most surgeons, but there have been a number of sort of level 4, level 5 evidence studies that have looked at growth disturbance, and they don't look properly. And what we know is we're probably missing an awful lot of cases, and we don't know if we're building a mountain of problems later in life because of that. How many cases get growth disturbance? If we look at our cohort of maybe the last 100 or so that we've done at Sheffield, there are two that I've picked up that have had minimal growth disturbance, but we've only picked it up because we're using EOS and we're doing a pre-op mechanical axis AP as well as a lateral of the affected limb, and we're following them up until skeletal maturity to see. And you will often pick up mechanical axis deviations. With the transphyseal technique, you tend to get changes that differ and correspond to each other in the distal femur and the proximal tibia because of the way the tunnel's drilled. So you tend to get varus of the tibia and valgus of the femur in terms of the distal alignment. So if you're drawing a mechanical axis and not looking at the deformity parameters as we, as pediatric orthopedic surgeons, have been trained, you're going to miss that there's a problem. So these are very common.
And what should be done about them? Is there a referral pathway, or who should they be referred to if there is a concern that growth arrest may be occurring?
So anyone that's doing ACL reconstruction in a skeletally immature child should know who they would contact before they even start doing the surgery if they were unable themselves to deal with the growth disturbance or didn't have the technical skill. Let's say, for example, an adult surgeon that does a high volume of adolescent knee injuries. That pathway has to be clear, and they have to be able to get that patient treated and assessed quickly. We all know that sometimes we refer patients, they're not looked at in the timescales that the patients think are adequate, or that we would if it was our patient, our family member, so to speak. So that needs to be thought about before, and that's why clinical networks are so important. You have to have the skills necessary to manage everything that might go wrong with the particular case that you're thinking about.
Now, a lot of the American literature talks a lot about different types of graft. What do you feel, if for a skeletally immature child or a child who sustained an ACL injury, are we doing hamstrings or is it bone to bone that the patellar tendon that should be used?
So I think nearly all skeletally immature kids do get a hamstring graft. There is some increasing interest in quads as a choice. You do have to be careful with quads graft in terms of harvesting, because with kids, if you want to get a certain degree in thickness, you may end up causing retraction of the rectus. So there is a learning curve with all graft harvesting, be it hamstring, be it quads. Bone tendon bone grafts, there may be a suggestion that although it's got probably different profile of morbidity, it might be something that's suitable for the skeletally mature adolescent. Certainly, if you look at registry data and studies that have published looking at heterogeneous graft choices, that BTB tends to fail less. But we've not really compared that properly in a randomized controlled trial. So that really isn't something that we're aware of at the moment. So for the moment, hamstrings is probably your safest bet. Quads is the alternative. But BTB, if you use BTB in a skeletally immature child, your chances of causing growth arrest are very high, particularly the anterior tibia, because of the presence of bone blocks. Although there are some people that will put the bone blocks either in the metaphysis or just in the epiphysis to get around that, it's not something that can be recommended.
And I've also heard you talk about lateral extra-articular tenodesis, the Lemaire procedure. Tell me, what are your indications for that?
So if we think back to the origins of ACL reconstruction and the modified McIntosh procedure, if you want to find the procedure in the literature that has the lowest risk of growth disturbance, the lowest risk of re-rupture, the place that you're going to find this is from Boston and the work of Lyle McAlea that's been followed on by Min Kocher. So that procedure is a non-anatomical ACL reconstruction with a form of lateral tenodesis. So there's lots of different ways that you can do a lateral tenodesis. But the theory is that it will control the rotation of the tibia, whereas a ligament in the center will not do that so well. And the theory is that in high-risk people, you want to do as much as you can to prevent and protect the cruciate itself, because the risk of re-rupture is so high. So the work of Al Getgood from Ontario, who has done a PRCT looking at lateral tenodesis with or without hamstring ACL, hamstring ACL with or without lateral tenodesis. And he looked at this in slightly older cohorts of patients. So they tend to be adults, but within, I can't remember the mean age, I think it must have been just under 20. His criteria were patients that had hyperextension of the knee and patients who were engaged in high-risk sporting activities or ligamentous laxity. So pretty much you can transfer that to kids, because a lot of them will be hypermobile. They tend to be predisposed to ACL injury, in my personal opinion. And say that what he found was a reduction in the re-rupture rate that was statistically significant with the addition of a lateral extra-articular tenodesis. So it seems common sense that we should look at it in kids.
And that takes me nicely on to sort of what you quote to your patients and their families with regards to re-rupture, because I'm sure, you know, these kids are young, they're going to go on and, you know, be quite active still. So what do you tell your patients? What do you put on the consent form, especially when you're talking about re-rupture?
I tell them for re-rupture, I will say there is a 1 in 4 chance you will have a further ACL injury, be that ipsilateral or contralateral, in the first 2 years after surgery. I talk a lot about contralateral rupture because the incidence of that, as you find the incidence of re-rupture decreases with the side they've operated on, the risk of contralateral rupture increases because people are predisposed to this, particularly the kids, because of the way they move, the anatomy of the knee, the way their ligaments made up. So I also will often quote them the figures from Sheffield, which if we look at a mean of 4 years, we have 8% re-rupture and 6% contralateral rupture. And that's 14%. That's high. I want to get that down. And I think we will do as time goes by. But the other figures I quote are from registry data and from large cohort series. And it's too high. And it's high for a number of reasons. And we've talked about some of the reasons for that already.
With such a high potential recurrence rate, is there a role for non-operative management? I know that there was a survey done a number of years ago, and I think it was 255 surgeons, of which 40% said that they would treat skeletally immature ACL ruptures without surgery.
Yeah, so I think what you're quoting there is the ESCA-PAMI initiative, which was the ESCA looking at what was going on with pediatric knee amongst their society. So interesting findings. Non-operative treatment, it's very easy to do that if you just want to wait till someone's bigger and then treat them surgically. But the question is, what happens to the untreated ACL injury? We know meniscal injury is extremely high. One thing to say is we don't know for definite that if you manage an ACL injury non-operatively, that they will get more and more meniscal pathology. It happens if they're neglected full stop. So a kid has an ACL that's gone, doesn't get any treatment. If they go into a high program, careful, close follow-up rehabilitation by a suitably trained therapist, some won't need an ACL reconstruction. They might not participate in any sports unless it's on the PlayStation, for example. For me, if they want to get back to contact sports and if they have any problems with instability, they will require treatment. And I can't remember in the last 5 years having someone with a rupture who's gone through rehabilitation, who does any form of sporting activities that's managed without the knee giving way. And if their knee gives way, that's when they accumulate damage inside the knee.
I can feel Dan Perry already wanting to do an RCT on this in the future. So anyway, we'll move on to congenital ACL deficiency. Relatively rare, but even in my practice, I've had two or three in the past year. Tell me how, you know, we normally pick them up quite early. It tends to be the parents saying, you know, their leg's just not right. They're clicking, they're giving way, they complain it's sore. And when you clinically examine them, it's pretty evident that they have ACL deficiency. And obviously we know that these are typically associated with issues like fibular hemimelia, et cetera. Tell me how do you approach these patients when you see them?
So the first thing really is that a lot of these children, they've been born without a cruciate. They'll have modified the way that they move and the way that they walk to prevent instability. And it's really interesting if you compare all our congenital knees in terms of their pre-op scores with other kids, they don't identify much of a problem until they're reconstructed and they suddenly realize what difference it makes to have a stable knee. Approaching them, clinical examination is most important. It also, you need to be aware of what the plan of treatment is for the limb length discrepancy. And the key thing, the reason we have a service is because of the amount of limb reconstruction that's being done and has always been done at Sheffield Children's. So we know from historical times that these kids, we can get their legs aligned, we can get them to the point where their leg lengths are equal. But what happens to them when they leave the paediatric services? What's their function like? And you only have to meet a couple of adult patients who have ongoing knee instability to know that that's an area that we've neglected. And I think probably because we didn't know how to treat it. Then we move on to the changes that we're seeing in limb reconstruction. For example, the use of intramedullary motorized lengthening nails, the grow plate, which might well be starting its use in the UK very soon. And we don't have the ability to protect the knees the way we used to with lengthening. So in the past, you'd be able to put a ring fixator on, you'd be able to bridge the knee. So if the knee did start to dislocate, you could do something about it. If they've got a lengthening nail in and you're 3 centimeters into your lengthening and the knee dislocates, you're in trouble. So for us at Sheffield, the reason to develop the service was twofold. One was to improve the functional outcomes in adulthood because of the instability. And the other was to facilitate lengthening safely with a reconstructed ligament, of which there isn't any evidence at the moment, but it's just what experience and the history of our service tells us. although saying that, we have now lengthened patients with lengthening nails and with frames who've had knee reconstructions, and it's made a difference. It's made things much easier for them.
When should these patients be sent to a specialist service? Because they come at a very young age. What age do you consider doing anything about their congenitally absent ACL?
So it depends if there's any other global deficiencies. Some of them will have patella malalignments or dislocation or hypoplasia. Some of them will have an absent PCL. The big problem is they all have very strange joint surfaces. So the trochlear isn't developed if the cruciate isn't there. And so the surgical technique to actually create the space for the ligament can be quite complicated. So really, you'd want to see the kids probably once they get to their walking age, which for most will be 2 or 3. And then what you can do is you can see how that fits in with the let's say, for example, the surgeon is planning to do a lengthening at age 6 and then a final lengthening age 12, 13, or contralateral growth arrest with epiphysiodesis, etc. So you try and fit the knee surgery into the child's life plan of surgical treatment and work out what the final goal is. Because we're at the beginning of the treatment of the congenital knees, we see kids who are adolescents now and coming up to their final lengthening with a precise. But most of the other kids, we're treating them around 3-4 years of age, at the stage when the epiphysis is big enough for you to do PCL and ACL reconstruction.
Another big part of the knee is obviously the meniscus. You know, I think on one of the courses I tell you was "Save the meniscus, save the world" is a common soft tissue anthem from surgeons. Tell me a bit about meniscal repair. Obviously, as part of the pediatric GERFT led by Mr. James Hunter, they're reviewing the data of people who have had meniscectomy versus repair, and it's one of actually the points that is looked at specifically and fed back to the institution. What has changed in the last 10 years or so with regards to preservation of the meniscus in kids, and who should be doing them?
So, I mean, I think a lot of people will do meniscectomies for meniscal tears that when maybe we shouldn't do. And the worry is that people are doing it because they've not got the skills to actually can do the repair. And remember, meniscal repair is not just a couple of, you know, disposable suture devices. You've got to be familiar with all of the techniques. You've got to be familiar with the adjunct techniques. If it's an isolated meniscal tear, do you do notch microfracture? It's good evidence in adults that increases the healing rates. Do you use outside in? Do you use in-out techniques? What about the other meniscal tears that are often missed, like the ramp lesions? What about the meniscal root lesions, which are a lot more common than we think? So you have to be able to do all of these things, and you have to be able to have the equipment available to you to do them. What you don't want to do is getting into the situation where you're performing a meniscectomy because you can't repair the lesion, or you don't think the lesion is repairable, because once that tissue is gone, it's gone. Saying that, meniscal transplantation is being more frequently described in children's and is always a fallback mechanism. It's like discoids. We know if you chop the whole thing out, it's really bad. But we also know that whatever you do, the outcomes aren't so good if you look at the patient's long term. But again, we still don't know. There is no evidence to say you should be stabilizing a meniscus, a discoid, once you've saucerized it. Most of the ones we see are torn because they get neglected and left too long before they're treated surgically. So it's actually a difficult field. And for me, the meniscal pathology is the area where we as children's orthopedic surgeons, where we've probably not been doing the right thing. With the ACL, we've probably been sending them to adult colleagues if we find them. And in some cases, we've been treating them if we have the skills to do that. But the one thing about the BISCOS survey was they identified that although most children's orthopedic surgeons won't consider ACL reconstruction, they will treat meniscal pathology. And that was probably the thing that was most worrisome when you look at the data.
And you sort of touched on there about discoid meniscus. What is the gold standard of treatment? I think, you know, you said saucerization plus or minus stabilization. And following that, even if we were to talk about a traumatic meniscal tear, what's your sort of post-operative protocol? Do you let them weight bear? Do you keep them in a brace? What's the sort of thing you do in your kids?
Okay, so the gold standard for a discoid We don't know exactly what that is at the moment. It should be saucerization. The stabilization is the thing that we don't have evidence for at the moment, because where people have looked at it, numbers are always small and there are no studies directly comparing stabilization with saucerization. It's all level three, level four evidence pretty much at the most. For me, understanding the pathology there, the reason the meniscus tears and gets wobbly is because it's not attached to the peripheries as it should be. So unless you deal with that, you're not going to know about it. And I'll give you an example from a couple of weeks ago. I did an MPFL reconstruction on a girl who 4 years ago I did a saucerization and stabilization of a torn discoid meniscus. The picture's looking inside, well, I scoped her as part of the MPFL. If you look at the meniscus and how that has remodeled, in the whole appearance is completely different. It looks like a completely normal meniscus. Now, you shouldn't base your judgment on one case, but if I look at my functional outcomes at 1 year and 2 years for discoids that have been stabilized, they're pretty good. But what I don't have is a cohort of my own I can compare those to. And again, that's where we get into difficulty, because you don't know if what you're doing is better than what someone else is doing, because that just comparison hasn't taken place in terms of the proper science.
Now, you mentioned their function outcomes, and that's something which I don't think we do very well in the UK across the board. You know, North America, everyone collects, you know, six outcome scores for every patient that walks through the door, but we don't here. Tell me, what do you think about recording outcomes? I know there is a national ligament registry, but I don't think it's valid for children as of yet. What should we be collecting in our patients? Which outcome scores would you recommend? And is there a plan to have a registry just like Australia has with regards to some of these skeletally mature ACLs?
Yeah, so the National Ligament Registry, the hope is that they will start to collect data for children as well. And the reason that should be relatively straightforward is because the scores used in adults, there are pediatric versions, although not all of them are validated. So the PEDI-KDC is one that is validated for young children, although only in one study. The PEDI-KUS is another study, another score that you can use, or you can use any quality of life indicator that's validated for kids. So you tend to want to do, for example, like the HSS-FAB score, and then you would use the PEDI-KDC if you wanted to. For patellofemoral problems, you'll get them from a general knee score, but Kujala, which is very common in the adult sector, isn't really used in children. So general score with a knee-specific score. In terms of registries that you can use, ESCA has got the PAMI ligament monitoring initiative, and they do collect data in kids, just kids with who are skeletally immature, who have ACL reconstruction. Although no one's currently doing it at the moment because of information governance, it's centered in Luxembourg, for example, but they collect radiological and surgical information on these patients, and be interesting to see the outputs, although the people that are contributing to this at the moment are small. My hope is the National Ligament Registry will have a pediatric version, and anyone who's doing it should enter their data into the registry when it's able to do so in kids, and certainly any who are 16 plus, you should be entering anyway.
Yeah. Let's move on to patellofemoral issues. Now, this, I have to be honest, is largely a burden to the physician in a district general hospital. They are complex patients, not only from a clinical point of view, but also tend to be socially as well. There tends to be multiple things going on. You know, it can be anything from a patella alta to trochlear dysplasia to versional issues, issues with quadriceps muscle bulk, MPFL, looking at the TTTG, and even then collagen type issues. And obviously there's a huge spectrum of surgeries that can be performed for them. What I want to know is, what is your protocol for your first time dislocators that you see? And then also for your recurrent dislocators, when do you image them? What imaging do you do? And then how do you plan to treat them? Which is a big question, I know.
Is a good question, is the $1 million question, because we see a lot more patellofemoral problems than we do ACL injuries. So if someone comes to my fracture clinic with a first-time patella dislocation, for me, nearly all of them will be managed non-operatively to begin with for a couple of reasons. One, because whatever happens, you're going to need to rehabilitate the knee before you treat it surgically. Two, because not everyone that has a first-time dislocation will have a recurrence. But what we're probably going to find over the next decade is we move towards risk stratification and deciding on surgery based on that. So as well as seeing a patient in clinic who's had a first-time dislocation, I will ask them, did you have pains in your knees as a kid, sort of growing pain type things? Has your knee ever given way? Have you had problems on the other side? I'll ask if there are any family history of patellofemoral instability, because that is quite a frequent finding. And then that will sort of determine with my clinical examination whether their risk is low for recurrence or high. Remember that of the kids that you see with a first-time patella dislocation, about half at least will go on to have a further dislocation. And depending on the risk stratification, that could be higher. And that only two-thirds of them will return to their previous level of sporting activity, regardless of whether it's treated surgically or not. So with examination, you want to pick up valgus, you want to pick up ligamentous laxity, syndromes, Marfan's, for example, which obviously you probably know about before anyway. You'd pick up if the patella tracks with a J sign suggesting trochlear dysplasia. You'd look at the instability. Is it just in 30 degrees, or have they got apprehension in further degrees of flexion, which again will imply that they have either patella alta or trochlear dysplasia? Is there a torsional malalignment problem? Do they have external tibial torsion, persistent femoral antiversion? If the valgus is bad, how bad is it? And these are all things that will determine if that child is going to come back. The only real indication at the moment, despite everything I've said, is if they have a chondral injury. So beware the kid with an acute first-time dislocation that comes into clinic with a hemarthrosis, because they have got chondral damage and you don't want to miss that, because that's something that we know is the number one factor that will predispose them to arthritis later in life, is the presence of chondral damage. So those are the ones that do get surgery.
And with regards to your recurrent dislocators, is there anything that helps you decide when to do what? I know that obviously there is an MPFL, but you can do a tip-tup transfer. There's Gramont's, there's derotation, there's trochleoplasties. There's so much to do. And I know you've mentioned a sort of 4-in-1 reconstruction for some of these complex patients. What is a 4-in-1 reconstruction, and how do you manage them?
So it's all done on an individualized basis, because every patient will be a little bit different and because there are no hard and fast rules. A TTG of 18 millimeters in a 15-year-old probably implies they've got lateralized extensor mechanism. But if the same patient is 12 years of age, it's abnormal. Patella alta is very difficult to diagnose on the standard imaging that we get, because how many times have you requested a lateral knee x-ray at 30 degrees of flexion and got 30 degrees of knee flexion? It'd be good to study that one as well. In terms of dealing with the kneecap, what you've got to ask yourself is, this is what I think is an easy way to do it. I look at the patient who I've decided needs surgery, and I ask myself, would a standard MPFL reconstruction be enough to prevent them redislocating and give them a good outcome? And for that, I would say risk of redislocation over the next 4 to 5 years, less than 5%. If I don't think that will work, I've got to ask myself, what can I do to increase the success of that procedure? So what things would make me think that? That's if they have patella alta, if they have trochlear dysplasia, if they have a lateralized extensor mechanism, if they have a torsional problem, if they have valgus. So these are all things that they tend to coexist. That's the other thing. The recurrent dislocators will often have more than one of these problems, and you've got to work out what's going to cause the best chance of good success with the minimal chance of harm. And there isn't a formula that's going to tell you that. There isn't a flowchart you can follow that's going to tell you exactly what you need to do.
And just to sort of side one there is, we're starting to see some younger patients coming in. I mean, the Jupiter study, which is currently being done by Dr. Sheetal Parikh in Cincinnati, basically has just looked over the last 6 months, have had a few hundred patellofemoral patients. And they said that the average age is around 15.8 years. But we are seeing much younger patients coming in with these problems. We don't tend to do sort of tip-top transfers, at least until they're a little more skeletally mature. Are you doing the sort of patella tendon distalization, the Gramont procedure, and how common is that to be done? Because I am finding a cohort that are younger, and I'm almost just like with some other things, biding a bit of time till they get older.
Yeah, so as of yet, I have never regretted realigning an extensor mechanism when I do an MPFL reconstruction. I have regretted doing an isolated MPFL reconstruction. And that's the one thing to remember. I say yet, because if I get a growth disturbance or an issue, I might change my mind. If I look at my functional scores at 1 year in patients that have had associated procedures, they always seem to have lower scores to begin with and the biggest increase where you realign the patella, be that in terms of correcting the lateralization or correcting the patella ulna. Bearing in mind, this is a group of some who are skeletally mature and will have had a Fulcus and procedure. The Gramont is one of the techniques you can use to medialize the patella tendon and a way where you can medialize it, correct the lateralization, and you can also distalize too. There are lots of articles that describe this. And for me, in the younger kids, these are the ones that are going to fail with an isolated MPFL. And I don't think it's good enough to say, well, we'll do this, and when you're bigger, I can do something better when your growth has stopped. I think the thing is people aren't really familiar with the techniques for the growing child and are concerned about the risks of growth disturbance. But the outcomes of a lot of these procedures aren't good in the published literature because they're done as isolated things. They're not done as part of a formal reconstruction of the medial structures, which by definition are damaged if the patient's dislocating. So I'm very happy with the Gramont. And my other feeling is in the very young cohort of patients, sort of the under nines, if you realign their patella, there's some evidence to suggest that the trochlea will develop. And if it won't develop, if it's not in the right place. So maybe that's an argument for doing more in the younger age group rather than leaving them till they're older.
And I'm sure this is an area where there's going to be a lot of work done in the next few years, at least with regards to that. As I sort of mentioned, the average age of these patients presenting in the Jupiter study was around 15 and a half, and actually probably similar with a lot of ACL patients. So these are patients who are typically seen by a pediatric orthopedic surgeon because they are under 16, but they are just under 16. Tell me about how we can transition these patients appropriately to adult services. And is there anything set up and who should be involved in that process?
Okay, so if you work in a, as most surgeons do, in a setting where there are adult and pediatric orthopedic surgeons working together, should be straightforward. There might be someone in the region who deals with adolescent knee problems specifically, it's a good person to know about, and then you can have that pathway available. This is one area that we're not so good as children's orthopedic surgeons, is finding out what happens to our patients once they leave our care. Now, some people will follow them up into adulthood if the facilities allow, but most of us don't have that pleasure. It's also more difficult if you are in a children's hospital, because then your transition pathway will be to a different trust. So that's where it probably needs more careful thought than it does do. And this is where having a network and having surgeons working together as a multidisciplinary team is helpful, because in that case, the person that's been involved from the beginning will be able to follow the patient up into adulthood as part of their adult practice.
In your BISCOS-BASC report, you also mentioned that the care of the pediatric knee should be delivered by surgeons who have experience treating both kids and adults. Tell me, how are we going to set that up? And is this something that GERFD is going to sweep in and say, you have to be doing X number per year, otherwise you shouldn't be doing them?
Yeah, the numbers thing, of all the things on the BISCOS committee that caused more difficulty, it was trying to describe a number at which someone is capable of doing something to a high standard. Because we're all different. We've always worked with knee surgeons who are gifted, and they can do one thing once and then they'll do the same thing again better than you could ever do it if you'd done it 30 times. And, you know, I'm not one of those people. I need to do things again and again to get good at it. Most of us are like that. So the numbers is a difficult thing. No one likes being dictated to as surgeons. We like the fact that we're allowed to do what we want to do and what we feel comfortable with. But are we the best judges of that? It's our patients who are the judges in terms of what outcomes we're producing. And we don't have a good way of collecting outcomes in the UK. So again, it's a difficult one in terms of numbers in quoting a figure. But what you should be able to do is be able to do enough to keep your skills adequate and to a high standard. And you should be able to deal with all the complications that might arise when you're doing that particular procedure. For example, if you can do an ACL reconstruction, you have to know how to repair a ramp lesion or treat a meniscal root lesion, or be able to treat a loose osteochondral defect and have the equipment there available. It's also about having the kit there. These are all the things that make a difference, you see. So numbers we have described in the basic viscous guidelines, numbers that we think are appropriate. How GERFD will affect us, I don't know. My hope is it will raise standards for all aspects of paediatric orthopaedic care across the country, because we have some very good surgeons in the UK who do fantastic job around the whole of the country, not just in one particular region. But it's not always the case. And sometimes kids get substandard care, or they get very different care just simply because of the postcode that they live in.
And I have to say, I think there was a survey you did as part of that, and it was amazing to see that 85% of surgeons did less than 10 pediatric ACLs if they said they treated ACLs. So this is obviously an area for development. And as you said, I think this is becoming a more niche specialty, which takes me very nicely onto how are we going to train the future generation to become pediatric knee surgeons. I was very lucky. I got to go to the Royal Children's in Melbourne. I got to work with Brian Lowe and David Slattery and do ACLs and do meniscal preservation and do patellofemoral instability stuff. And I got to go and visit Min Cocker out in Boston and spend some time with him. So I was exposed to it, but it's not part of my routine practice now. In the UK, how are we going to train the next generation of surgeons to ensure that pediatric knee is not forgotten? And are there any fellowship opportunities that you're aware of in the UK? Because there are plenty of pediatric sports fellowships in the US.
Yeah, and that's where we need to learn from. And there's a very interesting article from North America that looks at who is performing the pediatric soft tissue knee surgery. And there has been a massive shift towards a subspecialist area of pediatric orthopedic surgeons. We don't have that pleasure here in the UK, and partly that's historically because of the way the health service was set up. You'd have the pediatric orthopod who'd do all the kids stuff and would have an adult interest. But most of these guys have retired now. So that's why there's been left a little bit of a void. To get things better, number one, we have to be better at education, teaching, learning, show people how to treat the knees. And that's through the big efforts that have come through BISCOS, for example, the Basque BISCOS initiative, that's really useful. It tells people what their standards they can look at. Meetings, instructional courses, things like this for people to see what's being done and how it's being done and listen to the people that do it regularly. Training at the moment, if you wanted to do pediatric soft tissue knee, the pathway would involve doing a paediatric orthopaedic fellowship and doing a soft tissue knee fellowship. And that's what it means by being dual trained. The hope is we will have specific paediatric child and adolescent knee fellowships running in the UK. And we're just about to have the first one at Sheffield, which will open in October of this year. And that will be a joint post between Sheffield and Chesterfield, which gives the candidate 2.5 operating lists a week in volume. So when they leave, they can go and do the job and do it to a high standard. And that will be mirrored across the country, hopefully. And this way we will get where these kids are treated to have the quality to treat them. And what we've got to remember is there's been a big shift into how kids are managed, with less being done in hospitals that treat adults as well, and more pediatric specified care, because the support around the surgeon is the thing that's most important. It's your anaesthetists, it's your post-op ward care, it's your therapy team, etc. It's not just about the operation itself, it's everything that goes with it.
No, and it's fantastic to hear that you're starting up this fellowship program. It's, I think it's something that's going to be very much looked forward to by a lot of people interested in this area and who want to get into our field in general. I've been very lucky to spend time with you in a wet lab, and I learned so much in one day with regards to techniques with you in Adil Ajawid, and that was a fantastic day that I still remember, and I've still got my notes written down from that day that I can reflect on. So these opportunities are available, and more so is to obviously talk about the course that you're running later this year, the Congress. So this is the second International Child and Adolescent Knee Congress. The first one was in 2019, and the next one is obviously this year, 2 years later. It's the 17th to the 18th of June, and it'll be at City Hall in Sheffield. Hopefully, COVID pending, we'll all be getting to have a face-to-face meeting. And the last one was attended very well by both pediatric and adult soft tissue surgeons. And there was a great lineup of faculty. I mean, there was Lyle McKelly from Boston, Frank Ackerbled and Chatel were here from France, there was Nick Matardi from Canada. And I hear Chatel Parikh's coming this year, and I'm sure you've got some other big hitters coming in. And you actually gracefully shared all of their presentations after that with the attendees. And that's always been something I've been able to go back and look at. So people can learn about that. The Twitter handle is kidskneeconf. So kidsknee and then C-O-N-F. The website, I'm sure if you Google International Child Analysis Knee Congress will pop up as well. And we'll put a link in our description of this. Tell me, Nick, finally, where do you think this field is going in 5 years? What do you think we'd have got better at? Hopefully we're going to have more surgeons and more centers with the ability to treat this. And who currently right now are the people who people should be referring to if they have a complex patient?
So my hope is that probably over the next decade, what we need to plan is we're going to have people appearing who are specifically trained to deal with the child and adolescent knee. That's what for me would be the right way to do this. Whether that's a pediatric orthopedic trained surgeon or an adult knee surgeon that then subspecializes in this particular area, it doesn't matter, as long as they're able to focus on that area and provide high quality care. What we want to do is see good outcomes from surgery. We need to see better national planning of the service, better links locally, so people all have an option to refer complex or difficult cases that they're not happy dealing with to someone that will want to take them on their behalf. So where are people located? Well, there are people that what we're finding is there are new appointees who have come along who are now starting to do pediatric knee surgery. A classic example is Innes in Glasgow, who's recently started with the particular role of, in a big department, of taking on the pediatric knee. There are other surgeons like me who have been doing this for a number of years, in, for example, Manchester, Birmingham. Other hospitals have systems where adult surgeons visit and have collaborative working. It really does vary from hospital to hospital. So there isn't really, you know, it depends. You need to find out who's doing what in your region. And if it's something really complicated or rare, that's where you ask for help from sort of a major center, of which, again, it depends where you are geographically. It really depends on what you have around you. Remember, patients don't like to travel. And that's one thing we don't do well in the UK. Whereas in the US, they can all park and they can all guzzle God knows how many litres of petrol to get from A to B. In the UK, sometimes a 12-mile bus journey or a train journey is like moving to another country. Now, you find that regardless of where you are. So patients don't like to travel. They'll always choose local care. The only time they won't is if that care is not available or if it's of a lower quality and they know of somewhere better. So that's the key thing. Also, some patients can't afford to travel. So we have to try and provide services locally. That's, for me, really important. Only really travel if it's something that can't be done where you are.
Well, Nick, look, thank you so much for the time you've given us today. It was really interesting to hear, especially about your fellowships and that how essentially, through serendipity, you've landed in this amazing field of pediatric knee and how you've developed it as its own specialty. And to hear about the fellowship that will be released up in Sheffield later this year is excellent. Obviously, the role of discussing how you manage ACLs to meniscal preservation to patellofemoral, we've covered a huge amount. It's almost ortho hubby. So I hope Kash Akhtar doesn't take any offense when we release this. And I recommend everyone to check out the show notes. We'll be mentioning the International Child and Adolescent Knee Congress. I recommend everyone to attend, and hopefully that'll be a face-to-face thing. And Nick, I really look forward to seeing you again in the future.
Thank you.